Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. It's Wednesday, the 18th of October, 2017. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
In today's edition, will Kenya be able to hold a free, fair and credible election?
It's difficult to guarantee a free, fair and credible elections. Without critical changes in key secretariat staff, free, fair and credible elections will surely be compromised.
And new research reveals for the first time how oil spills are increasing mortality rates among newborns in Nigeria.
We think that after an oil spill, local residents are exposed to crude oil through skin contact with contaminated water and soil, through the ingestion of contaminated water, crops or fish.
Those stories and a lot more coming up shortly.
But first, let's hear what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Thousands of people took to the streets in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, on Wednesday, wearing red headbands and chanting slogans in a show of unity against extremism. After Saturday's truck bombing killed some 300 people and wounded another 400. At least two people were arrested and three people wounded in the rally. Scores of people remain missing after the country's deadliest attack. Kenyan electoral official Rosalind Akombe has quit her post days before a repeat presidential vote. She claimed in an interview with British broadcaster the BBC that the Election Commission is under siege and that she fears for her life. Electoral head Wafula Chebukati warned also that it would be difficult to guarantee a free and fair election scheduled for October 26th. This comes after opposition leader Raila Odinga called for a mass protest on the day of the election, telling a crowd of thousands in capital Nairobi that it would be the biggest demonstration of them all. Sitting President Uhuru Kenyatta, meanwhile, urged for prayers ahead of the vote.
The first step is an extended period of prayer and reconciliation this weekend. I have reached this decision to call on all Kenyans to pray for their country, culminating in a national day of prayer on Sunday.
Four British nationals have been kidnapped in Nigeria's southern conflict-hit Delta State, police told reporters, adding that they're attempting to rescue the four after they were taken by unidentified gunmen on October 13th. The kidnapping comes after the federal government said they hope to make violence a thing of the past in the oil-rich region so that they can build on its recovering economy. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. German party coalition talks have started in Berlin, where Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats and their Bavarian sister Christian Social Union Party faces a challenge in forging a so-called Jamaica coalition with the Greens and Free Democrats. CDU's General Secretary Peter Tauber told reporters the first round of talks with the Free Democrats had been very constructive. Political correspondent Hans Brandt told DW, however, that Merkel's position is weakened as her conservative CDU-CSU bloc didn't win a clear majority in the September vote.
Merkel can be certain that she will be chancellor of the new government, whatever it is going to be, because her party was the strongest party in the recent general election. But obviously her authority is weakened to some extent.
Zimbabwean First Lady Grace Mugabe is suing a businessman for failing to deliver a 1 million euro diamond ring. 52-year-old Mugabe said she ordered the 100-carat diamond ring last year for her 21st wedding anniversary to 93-year-old Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. And now in sports, German Bundesliga squad Bayern Munich face off against Scottish champion Celtics in Munich tonight, where Bayern looks to turn their Champions League football season around with a win. Both clubs are tied in the UEFA Group B League with 3 points each. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
Welcome back. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are live on Facebook. Leave us your comments there. We will get to them.
Now to Kenya, where Rosalind Akombe, a senior commissioner at the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, IEBC, has stepped down amid opposition protests that have been calling for the resignation of electoral officials in Kenya. Akombe cast doubt on the ability of the IEBC's readiness to hold a free, fair and credible election, a claim that has been supported by IEBC chairperson Wafula Chebukati. From Nairobi, Andrew Wasike brings us this story on how the Commission and the country at large have reacted to the news.
It is almost a week to the repeat presidential polls that Kenya's opposition has vowed to boycott. In the unfolding political drama, the Electoral Commission, IEBC, reacted to Roselyn Akombe's resignation. The IEBC chairman, Wafula Chebukati, praised Akombe for her work at the commission, saying that it is sad that Kenya could not provide a safe environment for her to work without threats to her life.
I'll not allow anyone to destroy this country as long as I'm the referee of this contest. Today, let me be very clear that I'm giving a yellow card to all the political leaders in this country. I'll not tolerate the threats on my staff anymore. I'll not tolerate the interference in the commission anymore. I'll not let the money of the Kenyan people or the development partners go to waste anymore.
Chebukati also said it would have been easier for him to resign, but added that he is pushing forward, cautioning Kenyan politicians that the commission will not tolerate threats.
It's difficult to guarantee a free, fair and credible elections. Without critical changes in key secretariat staff, free, fair and credible elections will surely be compromised.
The news that caught many Kenyans off guard was that Roselyn Akombe, a senior electoral official in Kenya, had fled the country to the US in fear of her own life and had stepped down from her position. Akombe was in Dubai overseeing the printing of next week's presidential poll ballot papers. She fled to New York saying she doesn't feel safe in Kenya anymore. Akombe told the BBC that she doesn't think that Kenya's Electoral Commission is ready to run the repeat polls.
I realize that we are in a difficult situation as a country, preparing for an election in which you have the commission not meeting all its obligations and yet not coming out very strongly to say that these are the challenges we are facing.
The last time Akombe tried to leave Kenya, she was detained at the airport until the Ministry of Interior cleared her for travel. The political atmosphere in Kenya is getting hotter and hotter as the countdown continues to the poll repeat date on October 26. Here are some voices from curious Kenyans on what they think about Akombe's dramatic disappearance.
Why then resign? I believe she should have helped the other commissioners to be able to come up with a way of solving the problem that she saw where she went. And I believe that is what Kenyans looked upon.
From her remarks, it also shows Chebukati is under siege. The IEBC is not independent at all. It is Jubilee that is driving the whole process.
In response to the current developments, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta held a nationwide televised briefing saying that he was ready for the October 26 repeat polls, which the opposition has vowed to boycott. He called on Kenyans to come together for a national day of prayer on Sunday, 22nd October, to pray for the nation as it goes through turbulent times.
That was Andrew Wasike in Nairobi.
And let's give you this response here from former anti-corruption czar, Kenya, also a Kenya whistleblower who left Kenya, John Githongo. He says, Dr. Akombe's resignation from IEBC, she's one strong Kenyan woman of integrity for standing for truth and justice at this personal cost.
We also have another comment from Owa, who wrote, after Chris Musando's still unsolved torture and murder, would you blame Dr. Roselyn Akombe for fleeing the country before resigning?
And Prince Young said, life has no duplicate, run for your safety, mama.
And for Tweneboa says, what about those who can't afford such trips? The vulnerable Kenyans should learn from it and stop dying for these self-centered politicians, because they speak sense whenever they are in opposition but turn to the opposite side when they assume office.
We will definitely bring some more responses later. Now, let's come to Germany, where we're currently broadcasting from. Nearly 1 month after Germans went to the polls, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is beginning the complex task of forming the next coalition government. Merkel's conservative CDU-CSU is holding talks with two potential suitors. That's the pro-business Free Democrats and the Green Party. It's known as the Jamaican Coalition because the colors of the parties correspond to those of the Jamaican flag. Merkel's first aim is to get the parties to agree to launch formal talks, but that could prove tricky. Her prospective partners have major ideological differences over a number of issues, including EU austerity, migration, and energy policies. Now, this is an analysis from political correspondent Hans Brandt.
Well, yes, it is going to be difficult. The biggest problem is the wide spectrum of parties that are participating in these talks. On the one hand, the Greens, obviously on the left of the political spectrum. On the other hand, Merkel's sister party from Bavaria, the Christian Social Union, which is more to the right of the political spectrum. And that's, in fact, where the problems are most likely to be at the moment, because the CSU, the Bavarian party, did very badly in their terms in the recent elections, are very worried about how they might perform in elections coming up in the coming year. So they are really very urgently trying to look for a political line that will save their political performance. And they're pushing very hard to go towards the right in the political spectrum. Merkel, on the other hand, is trying to stay center of the political spectrum, also in order to allow the coalition partners, the potential coalition partners, to have some sort of common ground.
German analyst Hans Brandt.
And still in Europe, a research from the University of St. Gallen demonstrates for the first time how oil spills are increasing mortality rates among newborns in Nigeria. The new study by Professor Roland Hodler and research assistant Anna Rudala from the School of Economics and Political Science at the University of St. Gallen finds that of the 16,000 infants killed within the first month of their life in 2012, 70% would have survived their first year in the absence of oil spills. That's around 11,000 infants. Professor Hodler spoke to me earlier, and I started by asking him how they came up with their findings.
So what we do is we combine two data sources. One is the data from the Nigerian Oil Spill Monitor, which provides information on date and location of oil spills. And the other data source is the Nigeria Demographic and Health Survey, and that provides the complete birth histories and information on the survival of children for almost 25,000 Nigerian mothers. And what we find is that the oil spills that occurred within 10 kilometers prior to a child's conception strongly increased the risk of mortality during the first months of life. So specifically, nearby oil spills increased the neonatal mortality rate by 38 deaths per 1,000 live births, which basically means it doubles the neonatal mortality rate. This is a huge effect.
In what ways do the oil spills affect or endanger the life of an infant?
We think that after an oil spill, local residents are exposed to crude oil through skin contact with contaminated water and soil, through the ingestion of contaminated water, crops or fish, also the inhalation of vaporized products or smoke from fires.
In your research, you have named the Nigerian government as a culprit. How is that so?
I think the research directly focuses on the health effect of oil spills on infants and not directly on the culprits. But personally, I certainly see the Nigerian government as one of the culprits. Some oil spills result from the lack of maintenance of pipelines, and others result from oil theft and sabotage. And in my view, it would be the government's job to properly regulate and control the oil companies and their maintenance of their oil infrastructure. It would also be the job of the government to prevent oil theft and sabotage.
What then can the people do who are living in this neighborhood? Do they stop to consume the water? Do they move away? What could be the next possibility for them, so to speak?
Yes, I mean, talking from the distance, it seems that, sure, avoiding contact in the sense that is making sure that there is no skin contact of children with contaminated water and soil, that food and water are not contaminated, are most likely to help. And of course, if moving away to a non-affected region is an option, then that could certainly improve chances for the family as well that their children are alive and healthy.
That was Professor Roland Hodler from the School of Economics and Political Science at the University of St. Gallen.
And a quick response from Kwabina Robot says, I think this woman did very well for the East African country. Keep it Africa Link. If you are just joining us, welcome. You are listening to Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jallo.
And Wanji Kamwaura, thanks for joining us live on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Coming up in this half of the show, the plight of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda.
When we arrived here, we were just in a bush. There is no proper medication. UN is providing for us food, but at times if you want soap, they say there is no soap.
And we are still monitoring your responses live. Kwabena, Robert, we see you. You say you're from Ghana. Keep the comments coming.
That's correct. But before we continue with that story, our series which began on Monday on why there is hunger in Africa. We go to Nigeria. The Islamist militia group Boko Haram has been raging conflict in the northeast of Nigeria for 7 years now. And although the Nigerian military has been able to report some successes lately, the fight against the terror group is far from over. There are always suicide attacks, and even in the liberated areas, fear prevails. The humanitarian disaster continues, and in some regions, it is becoming more acute. Why? Our correspondent Adrian Krish finds out in the village of Ran, near the border with Chad. His report is now being presented by Anke Raspa.
Farmer Goni Aba is on his way to his field. It's the rainy season in northeastern Nigeria, and he has to spray pesticides and prepare seeds for the next season. But he can't venture too far. For security reasons, he never lets the town of Ran out of his sight.
We had to leave all the fields that are further away because of Boko Haram. It's safer here, but there isn't enough land for all of us.
This is the first time during the conflict that Aba has been able to grow crops. Last year, the farmer says, he lost count of how many days he went without food. The Nigerian military provides protection to Ran. Its inhabitants have to stay within 5 kilometers of the town's boundary. All Aba has for security around his farm is the poorly trained civil defense unit. It's a 24-hour job, says Mohammed Abayai from the civil defense unit.
We patrol this area day and night. When we meet Boko Haram fighters, we either kill them or they kill us. We are not afraid. Even at nighttime, when we see a light in the dark, we go and look.
The impact of failing harvests can be seen everywhere in Ran. And now that the rains have set in, aid organizations are struggling to reach those people who need help because there aren't any passable roads to the village. Here's Peter Lundberg, the UN Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator for Nigeria.
This is a protection crisis, which has gradually turned into a food security and a nutrition crisis. It's a very fragile situation. We are at the very peak of the lean season, waiting and hoping that livelihood inputs and the agriculture support, providing farmers with seeds and tools and fertilizers, is going to lead to a harvest that is going to have an impact on the overall situation on the ground.
But despite this optimism about the future, many people in the region are struggling to cope. Professor Abagambo, an agriculture expert at Maiduguri University, says the government's response has been woefully inadequate. He's calling for better support for farmers.
You might give the people the seed, but then if you do not give them food, the seed you are giving to them will ultimately be used for food. Because when you give a hungry man, for example, 10 kilograms of millet, hybrid, go to your farm and plant. And then in the house, he has 2 wives and about 7 children, and the children are crying for hunger. Tell me the man that will have the heart not to give that 10 kilograms of millet to be grounded immediately, to be made into porridge to give to the boys, and then he forgoes the farm.
Farmer Goni Aba is certain that as long as the conflict rages on, people here will continue to go hungry. Many of his neighbors weren't able to sow crops before the rains, and so they'll likely have to depend on food donations for another year. Goni is determined to scrape some money together for seeds and pesticides. He wants to put food on the table for his family again.
And that report was compiled by Adrian Krish in Nigeria.
And Speratas, listening all the way in Ghana, is just writing in that greed is the cause of poverty in Africa. There is more than enough for all.
We have Shedrek Shakalika, who says there is enough food for everyone, but some leaders are so selfish They are there to make themselves rich.
And just to remind you, our top story today was Kenya, where a top official of the Electoral Commission resigned. And we've been getting your comments on this.
For example, Wesley Bwalya says, Kenyatta, President Kenyatta is doing everything possible to return to power. I wonder why African leaders are like this.
Well, still in East Africa, we'll come back to more of these comments. But now to Uganda.
On the spot.
Uganda has been praised for its refugee-friendly policy. For years, it has been home to many refugees from DR Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan. However, the unending conflict in South Sudan has put a strain on the country's meager resources available for refugees. In August, the number of South Sudan refugees in Uganda reached 1 million, forcing the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, to reiterate its call to the international community for urgent support. Jen Ayeko Kumet sought to find out what this means and how the South Sudanese refugees are finding life in Uganda. Her report is now presented by Sela Oneko.
Hundreds of South Sudanese refugees enter Uganda daily from the different border points. But how much can the country take? Uganda's Minister for Relief and Disaster Preparedness spoke to DW.
It puts a lot of pressure on the resources. But it is not just resources, it is humans, beings that are, their lives that are in danger. So we have no choice but to continue receiving them.
Even with the pressure on the resources, the refugees keep coming, many of them with high hopes. More than 85% of the new arrivals are women and children. 17-year-old Jane Yako is one of them. She shared how life is like living in a refugee settlement.
Actually, when we come, we see everywhere it was bushy. When we are coming for us, we thought that maybe they have prepared for us houses where to live. But after that, when we arrived here, we were just in a bush. There is no proper medication. UN is providing for us food, but at times if you want soap, they say there is no soap.
Lack of soap is just one of the many challenges facing these newcomers, as Nyako further explains.
You wake up at 6, you also reach home at 6. And at times, during bad weather conditions like rain, if they find you at home, it will affect our studies. We don't go to school. And also at times, if they find you on the way going, you will be washed by the rain and you come back home. Those ones with disabilities, because of the distance from the school, they are now staying. They don't go to school.
The recent arrivals are a representation of violence that has seen many women gang-raped, houses burnt, and several kidnappings, says UNHCR country representative Bonwell Kantande, as he praised Africa's largest refugee-hosting nation.
Uganda is so special in the way they are handling refugees, in the sense that they are not just saving lives, but also provide them opportunities for self-reliance.
The conflict in South Sudan erupted in December 2013. To date, more than 2 million people have fled the country, while another 2 million remain displaced internally.
Jane Ayeko Kumet compiled that report.
Living Planet Africa.
And from Uganda, let's go to Senegal, where 32 men and women are taking part in a new kind of reality TV show. Farm Factory is the first show of its kind in the West African country, created to lure young people back to the land and show them that opportunities in agriculture exist in their home country. Rural exodus, unemployment and food security, a lot is riding on one program. Its candidates come from all walks of life, and for 3 months, they are learning to become farmers for a chance to win a farm of their own and the possibility of a better future. Emmanuel Lande went to Agababu Farm, located 150 kilometers from Dakar, to meet the participants and the crew.
Stalks of young millet and corn stretch as far as the eye can see. A deep red dirt track cuts through the green and leads to Agababu Farm. The only discernible building is a standalone warehouse. It's separated into several large rooms. One for cooking and one for sleeping. 3 dozen empty beds and mattresses are lined up neatly against the wall. And beyond, through a doorway, more fields disappear into the horizon.
Le, 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 mama. Le, 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 mama.
It's 8 a.m. and the farm factory contestants have been up since the crack of dawn. A group of silhouettes stand out in the distance. They've begun their daily chores. Starting with weeding one of the plots. They'll live, sleep, work and compete here at Agababu for at least 2 months, all for the chance to win their very own farm, and it's all being recorded for a TV show. 25-year-old Aliou Seck is one of the candidates. Today he's planting okra, known as gombo, in Senegal.
It's gumbao. We're going to plant it here. We chose gumbao because we worked out that with the weather and the rain, we'll be able to harvest it in 3 months.
Before coming to Agababu Farm, Aliou only had basic knowledge of working the land. He didn't know how to harvest crops and plants. Thanks to Farm Factory and the on-site training, he says he's already learnt a lot.
Looking at us, you'd think we were real farmers, but we're just beginners, winging it. But once training is over, we really will be good farmers.
Real farmers are exactly what the show wants to turn them into. It's the brainchild of television producer Ousmane Faye.
Au-delà du projet de divertissement, ce que nous proposons.
Beyond the entertainment factor, what we're offering has economic and social impacts that will have consequences for the environment, which can bring about a social transformation for young people.
Apporter de la transformation sociale au niveau des jeunes.
As a child, Ousmane recalls his cousins coming to live with his family in Dakar and not really understanding why until much later. They'd left the countryside and come to the city looking for work, convinced there was no future in the fields. Ousmane wants to change that idea through his show.
We want to create a new type of Senegalese citizen, one that knows their roots. We all come from the land. We want to lift the taboos, remove the barriers, and deconstruct all the hang-ups that we have, that we carry with us when it comes to the rural environment.
The National Agricultural Agency is now providing training and new sustainable farming methods in an attempt to make farming more profitable, and the reality TV show will help shine a light on them. It just remains to be seen if Farm Factory can inspire similar efforts to solve Senegal's food security challenges.
Imane Lande compiled that report. Now let's go to our top story, Kenya.
Yes, where we are still receiving your comments. As you know, we are live on Facebook. And Balige Justine says, Kenya is doing bad.
Situation there is not doing well. Anyways, on our website, we also cover the latest Panama paper findings. If you haven't heard about it, it's titled The Plunder Route to Panama. It's a report by the Africa Investigative Publishing Collective, Africa Uncensored and Zimbabwe and ZAM magazine based in South Africa. This, for instance, looks into why Togo's phosphate is being sold for 2/3 of going rate to the Gupta family that has been involved in several corruption scandals in South Africa. Anyways, a response here from Ala Goa says, we've known this for years.
And Fanuel Kakoshi says, well, it's a common trend in Africa.
And we have a response here from Caleb Churo from Nairobi, Kenya. He says, African resources are smuggled out of the continent by the ones supposed to protect it, divide it equally, use it to better roads, hospitals.
And Charles Ogole from Kampala in Uganda says, Africa's mineral wealth has two enemies, African presidents and their military or armed rebel groups. And Western capital that cashes in an exploitative manner, the African citizenry must impose tougher punitive measures on their leadership.
Before we go, Wanjiku, a quick question to you. Where would you retire to?
why are you putting me in the spot? I would prefer to be out in the wild.
Well, it just reminds me because of the story on the farm. I know I want to retire on a farm.
And not on a golf course, you know, just throwing a small ball.
Definitely not interested in the golf.
I think it's a great project that they have there. Different kind of reality show.
It is. And it's really, really useful for the rest of the African continent. I hope this just gets transferred into the other African countries.
Absolutely.
That's all we had time for. I'm Abubakar Jallo.
And I'm Wanjiku Mwaura. Till next time.
Bye now.